Good morning. It's March 27th, 2020, and I, like so many others, just have a few thoughts on the coronavirus. So I'm going to throw out my 2 cents there to add to the rest of the pocket change that's collecting. First point I want to make on this is just that one of my biggest concerns and burdens is the church, and I am concerned about the church getting division within it because of the different convictions people have with respect to what do we do with all the information we're getting, and how should we conduct ourselves, and to what degree of social distancing, and should we cancel church, and if not, should we do anything different than we normally do when we're there, and those kinds of questions. So I want to advocate for patience with each other, and a spirit of generosity and love as we work through these things and process all the information and come at a conclusion. Also, it is important to remember that not all Christians are in the same exact boat. There are black and white principles and laws that govern us regardless of what boat we're in, and then there are things that are dependent on our circumstances or where we allow some freedom to act according to different convictions in a Romans 14 kind of way, based on our own understandings and settings. So a person who has a weakened immune system, or a person who is older, a person who has respiratory issues or things like that, may find themselves acting differently than others, and according to their situation. So first of all, by way of perspective, before I get into the main point of this, which is the coronavirus and the Lord's Day, or the Sabbath Day, whichever you prefer, by way of perspective, and I know many people have brought this point up, but it's still worth mentioning, the flu kills far more people each year than the coronavirus has thus far. And I realize we're not at the end of the coronavirus yet, and so perhaps that's thought to be an unfair statistic, and yet it's quite a bit behind the flu, actually. It's not even close. This current flu season, which starts in essentially November, maybe October of 2019, and continues on through May of this year, 2020, the statistics aren't all in yet, but they're estimating that it will kill around 34,000 people, somewhere around there, which would be about what it killed last year. The year before that was particularly bad. You may remember that. Hospitals were full of flu patients. It killed around 61,000 people that year. And by February of, I guess this would have been 2018, February of 2018, there were 4,000 Americans dying per week. And yet, as of last night when I checked, March 26th, 2020, the coronavirus had killed 994. Those are the CDC statistics. Yet, in light of that many deaths from the flu, both last year and particularly the flu season before that, no public gatherings were shut down, flights were not canceled, states and countries and continents were not quarantined, the media did not make any big deal out of it at all, particularly not like now. And you wonder what would have happened if they had, if it had been nonstop coverage of how many people are dying by the flu, would we have had this sort of response then that we have now? That's just a perspective. The virus, you've probably heard this, but it doesn't have any more effect on most people than the common cold, and it predominantly affects the very old and those whose immune systems are already compromised. That's not to say it hasn't killed some young people. It has, but statistically it's mostly older people and mostly those who are already compromised with their health. As of last night, the CDC reported 68,440 infections of coronavirus, but there are probably a lot more than that, because the tests are relatively expensive, and not everyone with symptoms gets tested or even goes to the doctor. So what you end up having then is testing bias or a sampling bias, they only test those who show symptoms. And that gives a slanted view of how deadly the disease is. It would look much different if all the people who had mild symptoms or none at all were also tested. And then you could compare that with the people who are hospitalized or those who die from it and compare that versus those who don't. But that's not happening. And even with testing bias, there's only 1.4% of the people who get the coronavirus that are dying. 1.4%. And that's not to minimize the deaths of those who are dying. It's simply to say that those statistics don't warrant the kind of hysteria that we're seeing, the sort of panic. This is not far more lethal than other things, and it is far less lethal than some notorious sicknesses and illnesses and plagues of the past, for instance, the 1918 Spanish flu. We are destroying the economy. We're putting millions of Americans out of work. We're destroying small businesses. They cannot simply go 3 weeks or longer without business and income. Perhaps we could say that it would be nice if Americans had more savings than they do to be prepared for situations such as these, but that's not the reality. And they cannot go 3 weeks without income, and we're making them do that. And now they're going to be filing for unemployment, which is more public dole money, more taxpayer burden. The government has no bank account of its own. It's all from the taxpayers, or it's from future taxpayers, our children. So this whole spirit of generosity of, you know, stimulus packages and so forth, that's generous, being generous with someone else's money. The economy, with respect to small businesses, you can't just simply destroy a business and then have people fire it back up again in 3 weeks or a month or 6 months. You can destroy it very quickly, but rebuilding it takes a long time. All the employees that were working there had to go out and find something else to do, and there is no guarantee that when all the panic stops and we return to life as normal, whatever that is, that all of those employees will then be available to suddenly return to their job. That's not, no guarantee. The loss of capital, the loss of business that company needed to keep making progress and making their business stronger is now set back tremendously. We're destroying our currency with trillion-dollar stimulus bills, adding astronomically to an already astronomical debt. But Americans today are so ignorant about the disaster we're creating financially, and we've been piling up astronomical debt for so long that no one cares. The Republican Party used to say they were worried about this, but not anymore. And to what great end, then, are we doing this? To keep from getting the virus? No. We're not going to stop it. It's going to march on, and according to the experts, and I'm guessing that's who we're listening to take our marching orders, they're acknowledging that we're all going to be exposed eventually. And if the statistics hold out as they have thus far, 1.4% who get it will die. Might be more, might be less statistically. So, no, we're not doing all of this. We're not destroying small businesses, destroying the middle class, destroying our currency so that we won't get it. We're doing that so we'll delay getting it. And in many states, it's essentially martial law. We don't call it that. And so, insofar as there's no troops in the streets with machine guns, we may not think of it as martial law. But if there's a forced quarantine, and we call it stay in place or something like that, what is that? It's martial law, practically speaking. And the stated goal of this is to keep hospitals from being overrun. And I'm not unsympathetic to hospitals. I don't want to see hospitals overrun. And certainly if you're a nurse or a doctor, that's going to be a real hardship. But, you know, triage situations are not new in the history of the world, where there's an influx of lots of people, and you just have to make triage priorities, just like in wars. But at what cost are we willing to pay to keep hospitals from being overrun? Are we willing to destroy the economy, destroy small businesses, destroy the middle class, cause massive unemployment, and all the problems associated with mass unemployment, a bunch of people sitting around with nothing to do, amass trillions more in debt for our children and grandchildren to pay off, and then let a bunch of prisoners out of jail, all to keep hospitals from being overrun. Is that what we're doing? It's not about avoiding costs and pain. It's about trade-offs. Somebody gets pain, and somebody gets less pain. It's a trade-off percentage game here. There's no world out there whereby we can avoid pain. Somebody's going to get it. I'm not saying, by the way, that saving money or that money, excuse me, is more important than human lives by talking about the economy here. I'm saying that we're not actually saving human lives while trashing the economy. People are still dying. We're already acknowledging, the experts are, that the virus is going to continue to spread, and we're just managing how fast it spreads. So given that we're not actually protecting ourselves from the virus, we're just delaying it, we're destroying the economy just to delay getting it. That seems to be what we're doing. Regarding being safe and prudent, just consider that there is no way to play it safe completely unless you go live in a cave in the mountain somewhere and eat crickets for 2 years. No one is playing it that safe. Every household is going out to get groceries, at a minimum, groceries, probably more than that. If you're still employed, you're still going to work and are likely interacting with somebody at some level. And even if you're never leaving the house, you're likely having contact with someone in your house who is the designated errand runner, who's going around and doing shopping and running errands, and that's a risk. Everyone, therefore, is taking some risk. There's no group of people that are taking no risk whatsoever, and a bunch of other people who are throwing risk to the wind, or are throwing caution to the wind. It's just a matter of how much risk are you taking, if we want to call it that, and determining what's risky and what isn't. And that is hard to determine, because you can't see this virus. If you knew that among the crowds of people at Walmart, where you're going to shop perhaps, that there were people carrying the coronavirus, then you wouldn't maybe go that day. Maybe you wouldn't go for several weeks there because, or several days, depending on how long they're saying the virus can rest on plastic versus cardboard versus the shopping cart versus metal and so forth. But you don't know because you can't see it, so you are taking a risk by going to Walmart. Are you being foolish and reckless in going to Walmart? No. Well, you're going to Walmart because you need to purchase necessary supplies. Prior to this coronavirus panic, most people probably were not preppers and stored up months of supplies in their basements in preparation for this. So those are the things I think that need to be considered just by way of perspective. Now let's get to the question of the Lord's Day worship and Hebrews 10:25, which says, "Not forsaking our own assembling together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near." So let me just first say that most Christians would agree that it is important to meet weekly for church, and that this passage of Hebrews 10:25 is not optional. It's not an option, it's a command, not forsaking our own assembling together, as is the habit of some. Most Christians would agree with that. Now, that's not a controversial statement. Most Christians would also agree that there should be a really compelling reason to cancel church. That you better have a good reason if you're going to cancel church. Most would agree with that. That's not controversial. Thirdly, most Christians would agree that if church is not canceled, you should have a really good reason for not coming if you are a professing Christian. Most would agree with that. So far, so good. But what about the present situation? Is the COVID-19 scare a compelling reason to either cancel church or stay away from church? Well, let me raise some questions that we need to consider carefully, and I'm just going to lay these out as questions. I don't think anybody has the luxury of not considering these questions. We need to consider them. Granted that it is right and good for me to stay home from church when I'm sick, so as to not infect others. I grant that. Is it right for me to stay home from church because I'm worried about getting sick? The former, of course, is love your neighbor. I'm trying not to spread a disease I know I have, or a virus, or whatever. The latter is more self-preservation. And of course, one could say, well, but then if I get it and then start spreading it around, that's inconsiderate to my neighbors. But remember that very few of us do this to avoid the flu. Few people, some do, but very few, stay home from church because the flu is out there every winter, and therefore they don't want to get the flu because then they might transmit the flu to someone else. So we don't reason this way with the flu, which has thus far killed lots more people, thousands upon thousands more people in the U.S. than the coronavirus has, and does so each winter. Next question. If it is okay for me to stay home in order to keep from getting sick from COVID-19, when do I expect to be out of the woods on the possibility of getting sick? They are only hoping the virus dies down at summer, hoping that it will, before expecting it to ramp back up again in the fall. So do I have permission from God to be absent from church until summer, at which point maybe the virus dies down? Can I be gone till then? Do I then come back for a few months before retreating to my home again in the fall, at which point I'll stay home from October through June of 2021? Is God okay with that? If you say yes, on what basis? What verses would you use to argue that Hebrews 10:25 can be suspended for months at a time, or even indefinitely? If you're currently canceling church or staying away from church, do you have a re-entry plan? What is the plan? When? What piece of news are you waiting for from the media or from the authorities transmitted to you through the media? What are you waiting for them to tell you that would say, okay, now we can go back to church? Do you have any idea what that piece of news might be? If you're staying away from church, but you're not staying away from work, what is your justification for that? That your boss requires you to come to work, but God doesn't require you to come to church? Where did you get that idea? Does your boss carry more weight with you than Almighty God? If you are not going to church in order to keep from getting sick, but you are going to the store to get groceries, what is your justification for that? That you have to have food for your stomach, but you don't have to have Christian fellowship and don't have to participate in corporate worship? Is the church a more dangerous place to go than Walmart or the local grocery store? How so? A question about the internet. Is the internet a blessing or a curse? I personally think it's both. It's a blessing in that the gospel can be put online and heard by millions of people all over the world who could never get access to it before. It's wonderful for Christian education and learning and knowledge. It's a blessing for shut-ins, for those who truly can't get to church, who have no good church anywhere nearby that they can get to. But it can also be a curse, not just because there's so much filth on the internet, but because by it, we can settle for flat-screen pastors and persuade ourselves that a flat-screen pastor is a pastor. We can be we can avoid being reconciled to a legitimate church nearby with whom we've had maybe issues with some people, because we can just go home and listen to an online sermon from a pastor 1,000 miles away, a church where no one knows us, no one is shepherding us, no one is praying for us, and to which we're not at all accountable. It can also be a curse in the present crisis, the internet can. We can just have church online and skip the fellowship, skip the corporate gathering of ourselves together, skip singing to one another in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, skip praying together, skip communion, skip having meals together, and all kinds of other things that we see Christians doing there in early part of Acts and so forth. And we can convince ourselves it's okay because we can listen online. But that listening online is just one small part of Christian life. God is working in this. There is no doubt about it. I'm amazed at God's power to shut down the entire world. He has shaken the nations, and I think that he's used the foolishness of the nations and the foolishness of man to bring this about, largely. He has totally trashed our economy and the world economy. He's put the world in fear, cowering inside behind their doors. It's amazing. But just consider, Christians, that the devil is also working at the same time. He could be working already to sow seeds of division, to destroy Christian unity, to destroy Christian worship and fellowship. He could be working to establish very bad precedent whereby governments, on the basis of a fact-starved hypothesis, have been given power to shut down the life in our country and around the world and church, and we just accepted it. Again, we have to have patience with each other and be generous and loving with each other in our differences and how we approach this. Not everybody's in the same boat. I understand that. I'm just suggesting that everybody needs to be working on these questions that I've posed. We need to look at God's Word for our instructions and get those in place first. We can't afford to set aside our Bibles and wait for the authorities to tell us what to do about church. I'm not interested in cooking up a conspiracy theory about how the authorities are trying to destroy churches right now. They're banning all kinds of activities, so I'm not suggesting that they're targeting churches in this. But I will say this, I don't think that most of the governors of most states are particularly burdened about the Lord's Day and the spiritual concerns of the church and the health of the church and the importance of corporate worship and fellowship and praying together and singing one another that Scripture tells us is important. I don't think that's at the top of the list or even on the list for most state authorities. And we shouldn't expect it to be. That burden falls to the churches themselves. I would imagine that in the mind of the average non-Christian governor or even professing Christian governor, that they're probably thinking, hey, no big deal. Christians can listen online. We've got the internet. What else do you want? But people who are not interested in church themselves, particularly a Bible-loving and honoring church, they can't relate with the Christian's desire to be in church every Sunday with the Lord's people. Their decisions, therefore, are not likely to be based on reverence for the Lord, but rather on political calculations. Well, so be it, but that's not our calculation. Our calculations are not going to be political, or shouldn't be. A question about principles. What is the preeminent principle, or is there one, by which all other principles are subservient? What is the law that supersedes all laws in the Scripture? In making decisions about Sunday morning church, whether to have it or not, whether to meet or not, various people are applying different controlling principles. Some may be applying love your neighbor. I've even heard some mention you shall not murder. Seems a bit of a stretch on that one, but submit to governing authorities. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Or Hebrews 10:25, if you prefer, not forsaking our assembling together. Our assembling together. Do these commandments just merely get jostled around in a bowl and they sort of cancel each other out? Is it a draw? I realize that different Christians are currently employing different ones, the different concerns, primary ones. What I'm questioning is that just a free-for-all where we can just pick our own prevailing principle out of the Scriptures and say, well, that's the one for me? Or is there one that supersedes them all? Indeed, there is. It's called the greatest commandment. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. That's the greatest commandment. Love your neighbor is the second greatest. And there's a reason that the former is the greatest and the latter is the second greatest. And that's because God is supreme over all other concerns and matters and persons. He gets first place. He commands the highest loyalty. Historically, the first four commandments of the Ten Commandments have been understood as applications of the greatest commandment. The first four teach us our duty to God. The last six teach us our duty to our fellow man, and they've been understood as applications of the second greatest commandment. And if that is a correct understanding, and I believe that it is, then you shall not have any other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself any graven image. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. And remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy are the specific ways in which we obey the greatest commandment. And if we set aside church in order to love our neighbor, and I mean gathering at church together, in order to love our neighbor, like that's our reason for setting aside church, then we've turned the second greatest commandment into the greatest commandment, and vice versa. So these are things that I think that we need to be considering. I am worried about where this is going. I don't see any end in sight on the basis of what the authorities are telling us, that the climate, the milieu, the concerns about the virus, its contagion ability is going to be changing much for a period of months. I don't see that in a week or two they'll be able to say, okay, now you can go back to life as normal. I'm thankful that our president is talking that way, but I don't know about the states, and what are we going to do, folks, with respect to church? Are we going to just be looking to the authorities who really don't care that much about church? Maybe their primary goal is not to shut down the church. Okay, that's I'm glad that's not their priority. But are we really just going to look to them and sit around watching the daily news waiting for some cue that it's okay to go back to church now? And upon what basis? I hope you'll think about these things and join me in praying for the church, and that God lead us through this wilderness and bring us to convictions of the truth quickly.